We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, January 11th, 2017. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guests today are Joshua Moore and David Francis. First up is Joshua Moore. He's the author of five novels, including Damascus, which the New York Times called Beat Poet Cool. He's also written Flight Song and Some Things That Meant the World to Me, one of O Magazine's top 10 reads of 2009, and a San Francisco Chronicle bestseller, as well as Termite Parade, an editor's choice in the New York Times. His novel All This Life won the Northern California Book Award, and he was on for that book a little more than a year ago, I believe. He's here today to talk primarily about his new memoir, Sirens, published by $2 Radio. Hey, Josh.
Barbara, good morning. So nice to talk with you again.
Good to talk with you. Let's start by talking about how Sirens came about. How did it come about?
Well, the short answer is I started having strokes, which was pretty crazy. I'm still in my, I was in my late 30s at the time, and I had three strokes in a couple of years, and the last one was pretty serious. The doctors figured out that I had a congenital heart defect where I was missing an entire wall in the middle of my heart, making blood clots have this, you know, basically like a super highway up to my brain. And they needed to go in there, and they needed to build a wall in order to save my life. That diagnosis came in January of 2014, and the surgery was scheduled for the first week of March of that same year. So I had about a two-month window where the doctors gave me one criterion. They said, stay alive. That was all I really had to do. And the way I filled my time was I started to write a book. Maybe not a book. Maybe it's better to call it a love letter. Because at the time, my daughter was only 18 months old. And if I had died during the surgery, she would have never had any conscious recollection of our time together. Now, from my standpoint, she and I have had these magnificent milestones. You know, I fed her her first bite of pizza. You know, I'm the first person to put her feet in the ocean or play her the Rolling Stones on vinyl. And she, you know what I mean? And yeah. She would have never known that stuff. So I sat down to try to write this love letter so she would know exactly who her father was. I mean, it becomes sort of a contorted and warped love letter because I didn't want to just tell her, like, about my facades. I wanted to tell her, like, the warts and all, no airbrushed, unvarnished truth about who her father had been during his time on the planet.
Well, yeah, the memoir feels so very honest. Probably one of the things memoirs have the hardest time with is actually being honest in memoirs, right? I mean, it's like, how do I tell them that? But it seems you have, and I am curious how you got to that place where you're able to do that, or if you're just like that. I mean, are you pretty much all cards on the table, I'm an open book kind of guy? You know, talk about, you know, being honest in your book.
It's funny that you mentioned that because the book actually came out yesterday. So my first tour stop was last night in Seattle. And I was reading, you know, about a 20-minute excerpt, and there were a couple really juicy, really personal moments. And I found myself as I was reading to this room full of strangers, why am I doing this? You know, why aren't I just burying my dirty laundry in the backyard like most sane people do? Why am I up here as some sort of emotional exhibitionist from a certain standpoint? And I guess the simple answer is that when my father died, I didn't know who he was. I mean, I had a relationship with him, but he was so interested in people only seeing like the good side of him. He was so interested in being this larger-than-life character. He was a Lutheran minister, but also had like a closet game show host living inside of him and was just pure charismatic with this huge infectious smile. And he kept everybody at a distance. And I was in my early 20s when he died, and when he did pass, then people started to tell me some things about him that I didn't know. And it made me so angry that I never got to hear his side of things. So I think that appetite for the truth probably led me to maybe overcorrect and just say, like, I'm going to leave an artifact so my daughter has the access or the potential to know things about myself that I'm proud of, but also things about me that I'm ashamed of. Things that even years removed, those memories have that poignant humiliation, you know, where the hairs on the back of my neck can still stand up, even though it's been, you know, 10, 15, 20 years since I did these things. And, you know, because there was that ticking clock with the surgery, I was, like, writing with such a fever. I think that also led to me deconstructing a lot of ego. You know, it's just like, I have to put it all down. I don't have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, that ticking clock was actually this really liberating presence. I think as artists, we don't think about a ticking clock as being freeing. More often than not, we think about it as being some sort of punitive measure. But in the process of writing Sirens, I found to have the surgery at the finish line to be this really, really liberating presence in the evolution of the book.
Hmm. So it never was going to become a novel. I mean, that was never sort of a consideration.
This one didn't feel like, you know, there are certain things that happen to you in your life that feel like I need to have some truth, but I also want to have some metaphor, you know, or construct some sort of metaphor to give me the requisite distance in order for me to do my job right as an author. Most of my novels are very autobiographical. But this one, and maybe it was just as simple as the stakes were mortal in my life. This one felt very important to just stick to the facts and try to be as truthful about myself as I'm capable of being.
Hmm. This would be a great time to hear you read from Sirens.
Sure.
Okay.
All right. And there we were on family day, 3 weeks into the program, us the addicts, them the intruders. I don't mean to make it sound adversarial, but I sort of do, because that's what it felt like. We'd been in a womb, and now this was the first stirrings of labor. Proof that we'd be birthed back into the world, and there was the chance that I could know life without being a caveman. The worst part of having them there was how little they knew us now, assuming we stayed clean. They knew us as drunks, IV drug users, people who smoked speed using broken light bulbs as pipes, people who mangled promises, people who burned money like wicks, people who hit their loved ones, couldn't hold down a job, couldn't stay out of jail, couldn't love their kids. They knew our crimes and our lows, and because they'd seen us at our worst, how were they supposed to give us the benefit of the doubt? And how were we supposed to give ourselves the benefit of the doubt with them around? When it was just us trying to make sense of a future without drugs or booze, that was one thing. But sitting amongst all the people whose hearts we gouged out, what gave us the right to expect better from ourselves, expect anything other than relapse? We couldn't feel empowered sitting with these eyewitnesses for all our sins. Like a suspect lineup, they could finger every last one of us. With them there, we were hopeless, doomed, preternaturally stupid. We'd never stay clean, never amount to anything. We were swollen livers, shaking hands, we were DUIs, we were abscesses. Everybody sat in these neat little rows of seats set up in one of the conference rooms. If you didn't know any better, you'd think we were there for a real estate seminar. The guy running family day had a tragic ponytail running all the way down to his butt. first thing he said was, does anyone know where the word addiction actually comes from? It's Latin, from the word addictus, meaning to devote yourself entirely to worship. To worship. Think about that for a second. Think about this congregation of junkies and drunks falling to their knees and praying for their God's love, knowing that their deity required more than mere prayer. And so if you wanted to belong here with us, you needed to speak with action. Show your devotion to this contagious God through debauchery and debasement. Needed to wreck everything you held dear, destroy everyone who had ever shown you kindness. And once you were alone and broken, only then would you be allowed to crawl in our coffin, our cathedral, and feel the thrill of worshiping pure despair. Addictus. To worship. To be a worshiper.
Thank you so much. That was Joshua Moore reading from Sirens, his new memoir, just out yesterday. You know, it has a really interesting structure between the present and the past. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about how the structure evolved.
Yeah, no, that was probably the most compelling part of the book's genesis, because in my first draft, I had told it incredibly linearly. And I came to the end of it, and I said to myself, man, I wrote that, and I think it's boring. And if I don't think it's a compelling read, what's a total stranger going to try to seek out? So I had to be a little bit more nimble with how I was going to approach structure. And the metaphor that I came up with was that the book didn't have a planet yet giving it its gravity. And I needed to figure out what was going to be that planetary body creating the book's gravity. And once I figured out what that was going to be, then all these other vignettes or all these memories from my family of origin could kind of satellite around that planet like moons. So then when I decided to not be linear but start the book with the morning I'm having my third stroke. So, you know, you meet me, the book opens in the first scene with me giving my daughter a bottle at 6 o'clock in the morning, and all of a sudden I lose the feeling from my right shoulder to my foot, and I'm in the middle of a stroke, and that's how the book starts in the first page, and then all of a sudden it's 10 years earlier, and then it's, you know, 2 weeks earlier, and then it's 20 years earlier. So the book becomes this sort of mosaic. I'm sorry to mix my metaphors there, but it becomes this way for us to take all these sort of individual tiles or these memories, and we position them in such a way that the reader has the opportunity to stand back and take in the overall picture, or able to see some sort of cohesive whole. So structure was huge in this particular project, and it didn't come till later in the game. I did most of the revision, obviously, after the surgery. And that was when I was able to be a little bit more critically minded. You know, when I was writing that first kind of panicked gust, I was just sort of writing this mixture of adrenaline and fear that I wasn't going to make it through the surgery. And that didn't kind of lead me to be kind of fastidious or practically minded. So I had to then kind of come back later and impose a more interesting architecture on the story.
Well, I was going to ask, you know, how did you get to the point, or how did you get the distance actually to know it was boring? Did it sit for a long time then between the first draft and then your surgery and then looking at it again, or maybe talk a little bit about that, being able to get enough distance from your work to know whether it's any good, because, you know, there's a difference between us becoming bored and the reader becoming bored. Sometimes we're just sick of our own stuff, and to someone else who hasn't read it, it's brand new and it's a whole different thing.
Well, this book never had any distance. I mean, that was one of the really kind of crazy parts of undertaking the project is that I think most memoirists would say, you know, at least 5 years, you know, like give yourself the time to be able to sort of like authentically inhabit what had happened in the past, but you also have the opportunity with a more of a retrospective voice to contextualize, you know, editorialize. You've been able to kind of gather your thoughts and have the opportunity to think deeply and profoundly about, you know, certain epochs in your life. I decided to err on the complete other side of the spectrum, where I wanted to take advantage of that incarceration of emergency. I wanted this book to feel panicked. I wanted this book to feel jittery. I wanted to invite the reader as close to the process of composing the book as I can. And what I mean by that is there's a meta narrator here who's constantly drawing attention to himself, saying like, hey, I'm sitting in the living room right now and I'm writing this scene, or I'm sitting on the stairs that my daughter fell down, wanting to kind of have this intimacy with the reader where she can actually, you know, hear the keyboard clacking. I felt like if I was able to get to situate her as close to the action as I possibly could, that she would become almost an active character herself. And the more active our reader is engaged, you know, the better the odds are that she's going to sign up and take the whole ride. You know, as a writer, I always think about how generous readers are. We're so busy these days. And if somebody is willing to give you 4 hours of her life or 8 hours of her life to read a book of yours, that's so cool of her, right? I mean, she's got family, she has a job, she has friends, occupational responsibilities, all of these things. And what does she have? Wait, 20 minutes to herself? 45 minutes to herself a day? And if she's going to be cool enough to do that, it's up to us to take her on the most, like, wild, compelling, reckless, confusing, like, insert whatever adjective you want here. Like, we have to tell her this startling romp. And that's our side of the transaction, if she's going to be so generous with her time to actually read a book.
Yeah. Oh, dear. We have so much more to talk about, and we have a few minutes left. Fortunately, you're going to be with us at the speaker series next Thursday, so we'll have a lot more time. But in the few minutes that we have left today, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the crossover from fiction to memoir, because mostly you're known as a fiction writer. Your last book, All This Life, was a novel. And, you know, I'm curious, you know, how being a fiction writer helped with this or distracted you from memoir. I don't know. What's the crossover?
It's probably too difficult for me to just say, like, present it as a binary, you know, like, this is how I was a novelist, this is how much I was a memoirist.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I was using the same principles, you know, a reliance on scene, you know, making sure that, like, my characters are in sort of, you know, spiritual and existential crises, making sure I'm holding their feet to the fire in such a way that, again, you know, a reader's going to feel that her curiosity is aroused. She wants to sign up for the ride. So I definitely approached this as me as a character. You know, I haven't read a lot of memoirs. I'm probably not supposed to say that. You know, I should probably be like, I've done my due diligence and I know everything that Mary Carr's written and Mary McCarthy and blah, blah, blah. But I've probably only read less than 5 memoirs in my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
So that really led me, I think, to have more of a novelist programming to make it this readable little bullet of a book. I mean, it's 180 pages long, but I mean, I could have written this book to be 500 pages too. You know, it would have been very easy to curate it in a different way. But I wanted to give the reader the opportunity that if she wanted to, she could read it in a sitting. or almost like a play. You know, you do the first act, you go to the lobby, have some peanuts and a glass of whiskey, and then you come back and then you finish the book. So I think the book would probably, I mean, I don't know this for sure, but I think it would only take like 2 hours to read the book. And I wanted to kind of create that panic, you know, where you're flipping pages, So it's structured a lot like I would structure a novel in terms of pacing, readability, and then making sure, you know, that the I voice, and me in this case, has incredibly high stakes. And, you know, with the threat of dying from the surgery and my daughter not knowing me, those were two really big ones. But the one that we haven't talked about yet was that for the surgery, I had been off opiates for 6 years, but in order for me to actually have the procedure, I had to relapse. So when I was on the operating table, and they, you know, they're pumping the good stuff in the operating room, Barbara, I had a, you know, fentanyl going right into an artery. So when I woke up from the surgery, you know, I should have been praising Gaia that I had been reborn, that I was going to be able to see my daughter grow up and roll around in the mud. But all I wanted to do was burn my family down, go get drugs, and lock myself in a motel room. Mm-hmm. It was probably the most confusing month, 2 months of my entire life, where my rational mind was like, what are you talking about, man? You have a beautiful wife. You have a beautiful daughter. You have a beautiful wife. You know, don't burn it down. But there was that other side, that niggling voice that will always be a part of me that just yearns for self-destruction.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I love the size of this book, and I love that you're going to be down here next week. So
I can't wait. We're going to have so much fun.
It's going to be great. Joshua, thank you, and I wish you so much luck with this new book, and we'll see you real soon.
It's always a pleasure talking shop, Barbara. Thanks very much for your time.
Of course. That was Joshua Moore. His new memoir, Sirens, published by $2 Radio, and as I said, he'll be down here in Orange County next Thursday. You can find out more by going to my website, penonfire.com. We're going to take a short break. And be back with David Francis. Before we go, let me just remind you that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are not those of the University of California Regents, but those of me and my guests, whoever my guests are. So today, they're Joshua Moore, who was just on, and David Francis, who will be with us. Don't go away.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just a thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby. I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart, I know I've lied. I've lied. such a long, long time. Looks like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you, my love, my whole world turns misty blue. Oh, 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 I can't, oh, I can't, oh, I can't forget you. My whole world turns misty blue. Oh,
and welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. And this show, along with hundreds of others, will be podcasts, hopefully soon, within the week. And you can find it on iTunes. If you go to iTunes and subscribe to Writers on Writing, you will get notification when the podcast is there. And if you can't find it under Writers on Writing, look for Pen on Fire. I don't know, different people find it different ways. But I'm back. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And during the break, playing was Dorothy Moore's Misty Blue, my current favorite song. And I've been asked who that is, and that's who that is. But we're back, and I'm so glad we're back with David Francis. He's the author of The Great Inland Sea, published to acclaim in 7 countries, and Stray Dog winner of the American Library Association Barbara Giddings Prize for Literature. He's taught creative writing at UCLA, Occidental College, and in the Masters of Professional Writing program at USC. He's vice president of Penn Center USA, and is here to talk about his new novel, Wedding Bush Road, published by Counterpoint. Hey, David.
Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning. I just loved Wedding Bush Road, and I would love to hear how the novel came about.
Well, I have tried for some years not to write about Australia, but I keep going back to where I come from. I grew up on a farm in rural Victoria, which is in the bottom right-hand corner of Australia. And this novel is reasonably autobiographical, I'm slightly embarrassed to say, so that it's set on a farm that I know, where my family's lived for 3 generations, and near a town that also features in the book. And, you know, I don't write with any great plan or structure, but I just started writing about this lawyer from Australia who lives in L.A., lives up in Laurel Canyon with, and has quite a kind of elegant girlfriend who's originally Venezuelan, or her family is. And he is called back to his family farm for one last Christmas with his ailing mother. And that's kind of all I knew. And I just started following that story, flying back there and then arriving. And the novel unfolded as it did and became Wedding Bush Road. So that's the short of it.
Great title as well.
I'm glad you liked the title. It was somewhat controversial, I have to say, with
really?
My publisher, but I love it. Yes.
Was there another title?
Well, not really. I mean, my editor wanted to call it The Ropes of Time, which to me sounded like some kind of soap opera. So
yeah.
I fought for Wedding Bush Road, and I'm glad I did.
I'm glad you won. I think it's such a it's such a compelling title. And I also really love the first person present tense. I found it so compelling, and I'm curious how you decided on that.
Well, I'm also glad to hear you say that, because in writing courses throughout the country, they say don't do the first person, and certainly don't do the first person present. But I love the immediacy of the first person. So as a writer, I feel like I can inhabit characters in a particular way, and then in the present it feels even more immediate. So I, as a writer, am constantly compelled by the story. What was, I think, a little adventuresome was to be writing from various points of view in first-person present. I don't know that I've seen that done before, but hopefully the different perspectives are, the voices are particular enough and individual enough that it works.
Yeah, I think it works pretty well. But, you know, I as you were talking, I was thinking of a quote I just saw by William Zintzer, who is a writer of writing books mm-hmm. and teaches mm-hmm. writing. And he,
absolutely.
And the quote was something to the effect of, writers should write in first person. That's how you live.
Exactly. and I think readers respond to it also, because there's a way that you can feel very much inside the story and inside the character's mind or minds. And I think it's accessible. It can become tiresome if the prose isn't sufficiently well crafted, that it, you know, the I can be challenging. But just as a general experience for me, I love the first person, and I'm a big fan of it. And you know, I like to live in the first person. And I also, my first novel was in the first person in the past. My second novel was in the third, and then this is in the first person present. So it's sort of been an evolution for me.
Hmm. Now, earlier you said that the novel was largely autobiographical, and of course, when a fiction writer says that, I always say, well, was it ever possibly a memoir?
Well, I kind of call it an embellished memoir. And I think the danger with memoir is that you're more compelled to the facts or compelled to run with the facts. Whereas in this kind of writing, there is more of an emotional truth that bubbles up, and which is more important. And one doesn't have to be so wedded to the actual events. I mean, this is based on events that happened in my life and my family's life, but is not absolutely tied to them. So it gave me more scope, and it was more fun to write. And also, I wasn't quite so accountable to the people who I was writing about. Although I have to say, I did, when it was published in Australia, I did change some more of the names. and I hope that the version that's published here in America doesn't start floating around in Australia. But other than that, it's it's the town is where I grew up, as I said, and the farm is where I grew up, and there is a mother and a father who are sort of vaguely based on my parents. And I mean, in real life I have siblings, which never seem to appear in my novels, but I write to somehow work my way through various periods of my life, and this novel, I think, gets me through into my mid to late 30s, and the one before got me through my 20s, and my first novel was sort of a childhood and a family history, and so I also feel like I write to work out, I think someone famous said, I write to work out what I think about things. And it's a way of trying to understand, where I come from and who I am. And it's very much about belonging and the yearning for home and the romanticizing of home and the reality that you can't always go home in the way that you think you can. And this novel, Wedding Bush Road, is an exploration of how one can go home and sort of devolve into the person you were before you left. And that sort of that's an insidious process of how the forces in the place where you come from can array against you.
Mm. And I'm going to guess that it couldn't be memoir as well because of the climactic scene.
That's true. because if that. Were memoir, there would be repercussions, legal repercussions. Yeah, I mean, it does end up with some fairly astonishing events that I certainly never imagined when I was writing the book. because, you know, that's not how I write, and I allow each sentence or each word even to inform the next and unfold in a way that it becomes an adventure for me as the author, and things become revealed in ways that I don't expect. So the hope is that if I don't expect them, then certainly the reader will not.
Mm. There's so many great sensory details throughout this novel, and I'm always just so envious of that ability, because I think it can be difficult, you know, honing in on what little telling details about a character will show you that character, like Isabel's Venezuelan eyebrows, I think, is one of them right at the beginning. And I wonder if you get that as in your first draft, or if when you're going back to revise, if you're looking at telling details and sensory details, and how can you kind of really, really nail it?
Well, I'm not someone who advocates a rough first draft. I work very hard on each scene before I progress to the next, because I want to make sure I'm going in the right direction, because I don't know which direction I'm going in.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's important for me to have really honed those details so that the sensory descriptions, they evolve in a second or third draft, but they're there from the beginning, because that's how I see it and that's how I inhabit it. And that in that farm that much of this novel is set on, that's a place I see very clearly. So those details really live in me. And my last novel that was set in Cold War Moscow, or Moscow, as we say here, was more of a stretch, because I'd been there for a month in the summer during the Soviet era, but the novel was set in the winter in the same year. So that involved sort of more research and more of a stretch of my imagination, whereas this novel is very much lying in my DNA and just, needed to be dug up, because I dream about that farm and I spend a lot of time musing about that place and my childhood, and from this distance I see it in a particular way with a particular objectivity, I think.
Mm. Well, I'd love to hear you read from Wedding Bush Road. Would you do that?
I'm sure. I can read for a couple of minutes from the very beginning,
okay.
Which is when he's on his way. Daniel, who's our youngish lawyer from LA, is heading back to the farm in Australia, and he's actually kind of in his half sleep on the plane, and remembering why he's going. In the middle of the night, that bloody Sharon's car was up in flames, my mother shouted down the phone. I imagine her moving through the paddocks in the dark, the distant flicker, the way she knows the land by heart, the shapes of the concrete water troughs, the shadows of the rabbit warrens, and a siren wailing, the fire truck already on the highway, and my mother breathless by the windmill. She'd leave the gate open, let the wild-eyed cattle shuffle through the clatter of their hooves. The shadows of those three black horses retreating and advancing, snorting at the burning Mitsubishi, arching up with fear. My mother, too old for fighting fires in the dark, said she gave up swinging her coat when she noticed a piece of my grandmother's sideboard, an ornate hacked-off corner. My grandmother's antiques had survived the passage from Coventry 90 years ago, but not the wrath of Sharon Wells, not even the bed where my grandmother died with the book of shrubs on the pillow beside her. Then I saw the burnt rocking horse, my mother said. I imagine its silver mane and leather bridle incinerated. My grandmother rocked me on it as a boy, hers as a child in England, shipped out to what she called these frightful antipodes. Your father's a sloven and a slut, my mother said, chasing after a hoon like Sharon. My father's name is Early, a family name. Better early than not at all, my mother used to say, but she doesn't say that anymore. He now lives 5 miles away in a sad-looking brick veneer, a coastal subdivision my mother's christened Bitter Snug, after she threw him off his own farm, out of the big house, and sentenced him to life with Elsie. Elsie's the father's current girlfriend. I roll my bag along the bluestone path, a lump in my throat as I pushed the door open, the vague smell of compost and frantic yelping, and I glimpsed my mother in the dining room, alive and mobile, armed with a broom and a fly swatter. As I enter, a brush-tailed possum scratches its way along the picture rail. It pisses with fright on the portrait of Aunt Emma Charlotte, then over the pastel of me as a boy, the innocent eyes that were never quite mine. My mother doesn't notice me, mesmerized by the leaping dog and the hiss of the possum as it plummets to a corner table, smashing plates. It hurtles out past me through the open doors and into the warm Gippsland evening. My mother turns, "Hello, my boy," as if knowing I was here all along. "How was your trip?" She hoists the broom over her shoulder like a rifle. I give her a hug, but her body stiffens as if she's afraid it's too American. "Did you get yourself an upgrade?" She doesn't wait for an answer, already involved in a project on a kitchen bench, as if I'm a ghost that often appears. Still, I wonder how she's heard of upgrades. She's irrigating ants from a cupboard, wiping them up with an ant-speckled cloth. My mother slaughters armies of them, shows off piles of the dead to occasional visitors. Magpies and noisy miners fly down these chimneys seeking shade, as the blackened ant dog lies in wait to land them, stunned and breathless on the hardwood floor. On the silent television, the marsupial eyes of the new prime minister. I'll stop there. I could go on, but I'll stop there.
That's great. And it's great, really, listening to you read, because you have such a great reading voice. And
thank you.
Like we could go on like this, but I guess we do have to.
But I shan't.
We have to talk a little bit more. You know, there's still a lot I want to talk to you about, but one of the things is writing love scenes, because you have quite a captivating one. I think it's around page 152. It's captivating, and it's difficult to do, I think. You know, writers, especially new writers, are always saying, "Well, how do you make it not porn?" You know, well, you know, it you know it when you see it, right? But talk about that, if you would, just how you got it just right. And do you think you did?
No, I think I did, and I worked hard to do that. I think it's partially about not focusing only on the sex of it, but on the details. So it's experienced from the first person, or in the first person, and described in that voice, so that there are details that appear in that scene. And I think that's the scene that happens out in the bush, as we say in Australia, out in the... There's this sort of clearing and this grassy area where Daniel, our hero, and this rough woman who's a tenant on the farm named Sharon Wells have this experience. And so he's left his lovely girlfriend back here in L.A., and she's going to Esalen for a yoga retreat while he goes out to deal with his family drama. And he's somehow seduced... and reverts to his old self in this attraction to this feral woman, Cheryl, who has a certain allure and an earthiness that he connects with when he's back there. So the sex scene, I don't know whether it's really a love scene, it's more of a sex scene in a way, is very earthy, and it's in the grass. So it's in an environment that's more interesting in a way to write about, because there's grass and there's the bush and there's the smell and look and feel of things in a particular environment, so that it's not just about the sex. And that would be my suggestion, not to focus totally on the mechanical experiences, but on the feelings and the memories and the odd things one can think about. You know, there's an Australian expression that that women often use about lie on your back and think of England, but there is this other sort of consciousness that's going on in parallel to the actual experience. Yeah. And then there's the physical environment that's infusing the scene as well. And I think if there can be a melange of those aspects, then it can be a very rich and not just a vaguely pornographic, stereotypical cliche.
Good way of describing it. I also wanted to comment on the beginning, the very beginning of the novel and the very end, because in terms of location and emotion, they match. And it seems that's my favorite sort of thing to, you know, with novels, is having the beginning and the ending match somehow. Again, was that on purpose? And it doesn't sound like you had an ending in mind when you began, but maybe talk a little bit about how that worked out.
Well, oddly enough, I sold the novel to Counterpoint Press with a slightly different ending, in that about three-quarters of the way through the novel, Isabel, the girlfriend from L.A., mm-hmm. Appears unexpectedly on the farm. She's up at Esalen. She speaks to him on the phone, and she knows that very strange things are happening, and he seems different and estranged, and she gets panicky and thinks she's going to go out and surprise him, and as those surprises go, it didn't go very well. And when I sold the novel, my editor, Dan Smetanka, said, you know, it works beautifully, but I don't think Daniel, as the narrator, really resolves why he goes out there and what he needs to learn during the course of the novel. So I worked very hard to rework the last third or so, or maybe quarter, without Isabel coming out and arriving on the drive at the farm, and Daniel really sticking with it and working through all this stuff that's emerged out there, and genuinely deciding whether he should stay or return. And the novel begins up in Laurel Canyon in this guest house, which is where I used to live when I first came to L.A. I lived up on Wonderland Park Avenue in L.A., in the guest house of a woman called Susan Oliver, who was sort of a blonde bombshell actress in the 50s and 60s, who died very tragically from leukemia. And I lived in this wonderful little spot where there was a creek at the bottom of the garden, and that always resonated for me. So the novel begins there at Christmas, just before Christmas, with Daniel and Isabel, with him packing, and then her taking him to the airport on a very rainy L.A. night. And then in the end, he does determine to go back. So it is bookended in Laurel Canyon, and that wasn't intended, but you know, it made sense in the evolution of the novel. And you know, the Wedding Bush Road took him back to L.A., which I guess is, you know, he realizes is his home. So that Australia is the place where he's from, and California is his home. And I feel very much like that. I've been here 30 years now, on and off, and mostly in L.A., and I've had, you know, writing fellowships to live in Paris for 6 months, and I went back there a lot, and I was very connected with Paris and very connected with the farm I come from, where I go back each year. And but in the last year or so, I've realized that, you know, L.A. is my home, and I oddly love my life in L.A., and I love California, and, you know, even though there are some challenges as we speak, this is where I belong, and this is where I became a writer. And I, you know, I might never have become a writer had I not ended up washed up here.
Interesting. And we're at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any last words or any little pearls of wisdom for the writers listening who may be battling their way through a novel.
All I would say to writers who are listening is I commend your bravery being out there in that lonely, wonderful writing world. And what I would, or my two cents worth, is that I think it's so important to write what you need to write, not what anyone else thinks you should write, or not what any audience thinks you should write. And I think it's important to write what no one else can, that story that only you can write and that you need to write is what will get you into a fulfilling place when you finish what you've written and not feel like you've compromised. It might not earn you an awful lot of money, but it'll be what feels intrinsic and real and genuine.
Mm. Thank you so much, David. And thank you for writing Wedding Bush Road. I love it.
Thank you, Barbara. Great talking to you. And I'm delighted to be on your show.
Thank you. That was David Francis again. His novel is Wedding Bush Road, published by Counterpoint Press. Loved it and highly recommend it. Again, this show, along with the others, will be podcast within the next week, most likely, and you can find that at penonfire.com. Thank you for listening, and you writers out there, stay in the chair, right? You got to stay in the chair if you want to get it done. See you soon.